tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
Radio Basics. I'm Steve, and I'm here with my co-host, Kabir.
Hello, what's up, Toronto? This is Radio Basics on CHRY Radio.
105.5, people. Thanks for listening in. It's Monday night. This is Radio Basics on our new day, same time, 8 to 9. Thank you for listening in. We got a big show ahead of us tonight. We're going to be talking to Asad Ismi, Toronto radio journalist and correspondent for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives Monitor. He's going to be talking about imperialism in Africa, particularly in the Congo, and the recent situation that's been developing in the Congo. We're also going to be talking to Anyanya Mukherjee-Reed, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science here at York University. And she's going to be talking about the terrorist incidents in India, in Mumbai. And we're going to be talking about, who benefits from these terrorist incidents, and you know who might really be involved in these incidents. We're also going to be talking to Kabir for a minute about some local community organizing, Hood to Hood, Set It Off Girls Group, No Cops, and Basics are going to be doing a launch event on December 10th. Kabir, what do you got for that?
Definitely. So recently there's a newly formed coalition, actually called the Newly Organized Coalition Opposed to Police in Schools. It's formed of teachers, students, parents, youth coming together to oppose this new measure to put armed police in Toronto schools that you've heard featured on this program, Radio Basics, a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, there's already plans to expand this program to add new schools to the list. Recently, there was a stabbing up in C.W. Jeffries near Jane and Finch area. This is, of course, the school where Jordan Manners was killed last year. Mm-hmm. Two years ago, and his death was tragically used and exploited by the TDSB, by the police, to help push forward this measure to put armed police in schools. And so recently, with this recent stabbing, again, you've had an uproar from the corporate media demanding that, you know, since C.W. Jeffries, or making the connection that because C.W. Jeffries didn't have an armed cop, that's why this stabbing could occur. And now there's already been a pressure to put police in schools in the Jane and Finch area. So we can see that, you know, this program, they're not stopping this program. They're only about expanding it. And it's right now, we've concluded that it's right now in the first few months, in the first year of this project's implementation, that it's the time to resist it and the time to get police out of Toronto schools.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of response have you been having from the community, from parents, teachers, people in these schools?
Students, it's been very positive. Recently, one of our members attended a parent or a community discussion at Jane and Finch following the stabbing, and almost unanimously, not completely unanimously, but the majority of the room was against having police in school.
Really?
And still, you know, maintained the same position they had back in the summer, that they did not want police in schools in that ward. Which was very positive to see. Of course, the media actually only interviewed, the corporate media only interviewed the one parent or the mainly outspoken person who was for the measure. In addition, we've been doing a number of workshops with students, with high school youth here in Toronto. And again, the response has been very positive from kids.
Yeah, I heard that the No Cops did an event, or I guess a workshop, at the Ruckus Conference on Friday.
Yes, the Ruckus Conference this Friday, as well as the No One Is Illegal Conference earlier last month in November. The high school students at both of those conferences responded very positively against having police in school, in their schools, and genuinely wanting to organize against it. Including, in fact, we've had a number of successes at Weston Collegiate, which is a school near the Jane and Lawrence area. And actually, there was a point at which students actually came out and shouted the the policemen in their school off the school campus. They were so angry about this new measure. And they're also getting plugged in and involved in the campaign. So yeah, there's been only positive and support for this coalition is what we've received from the community.
So that's the No Cops part of this event that's going to be happening on December 10th. Tell us about the two other groups that are going to be organizing this event, Set It Off and Hood to Hood. What are they up to?
Definitely. So Set It Off, it's a girls group, a girls club in a number of high schools in the city, in Sir Sanford Fleming, in Lawrence Heights, in Westview, in Jane and Finch, as well as a chapter yet to be set up in Weston, or still being set up in Weston. There's about 50 girls, as I understand, or even more in each of those chapters.
Is it actually a women's organization?
It is a women's organization, a young girls organization, dealing with a number of issues around that. And yeah, they're having a lot of positive response in each of those schools. And so they're going to be one of the main people that are going to be organizing this event that's going down. It's going to be a launch party as well as a launch rally for No Cops, the newly organized coalition opposed to police in the schools, Hood to Hood, which is also a newly organized collective of individuals who are working to organize young men in these same areas, as Set It Off and other groups are operating in, to bring them together to unite revolutionary youth from different hoods in Toronto that are right now at war, to end this horizontal violence and instead direct attention to the real, you know, causes of crime, drugs, guns in this society, which is the state. And so all these three organizations are coming together, and it's going to be happening to next week, Wednesday, December 10th, at the Anneat Africa Dub Theater, 62 Fraser Avenue. That's King and Dufferin, downtown near Parkdale, two blocks east of Dufferin and Liberty. And that's, again, going down Wednesday, December 10th, from 4:30 to 9:30 p.m. It's going to be a six-hour event that's going down there.
So it's a political rally and a music event, and it's also...
There'll be political speakers from all of the three organizations, as well as some of the best hip-hop and reggae performances in the city. Some youth, as well as artists that are directly involved in the campaign as well. So it's going to be political music, too.
Right on. So if people want more information about that, they can, they can check out the Basics website. We'll put that information up in the next day or two.
Definitely.
So that's basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. Once again, that's on December 10th. Check out our website for more information. We're going to go to commercial, and we're going to be back with Assad Ismi on the civil war and imperialism in the Congo. Welcome back, Toronto. You are listening to Radio Basics, and the song you just heard was Lumumba by Bonnie and Skitter off of one of the many great Studio One reggae albums. Patrice Lumumba, after whom the song was named, was the first democratically elected president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, elected in June of 1960. In 1961, Patrice Lumumba would be executed by the Belgians and the Americans. I think that I might have cried the first time I heard that song. Was also just after I had watched Raoul Peck's film by the same name, Lumumba. And it was a time in my life when I was just beginning to learn about events in Central Africa, the history of Central Africa, the Congo, and also the so-called Rwandan genocide. And all this prompted me to begin my own investigation, and what I eventually discovered was that the affairs of Central Africa in recent history, as we've come to know it in the Western press, has been grossly distorted and maliciously slandered. What has come to be known as the so-called Rwandan genocide of 1994 was neither the beginning nor the end of the genocide that has been ongoing in Central Africa for almost 20 years, and in fact was only the beginning of the West's plot to completely take over one of the most resource-rich places in the world, the Democratic Republic of Congo. In the Democratic Republic of Congo alone, since the mid-1990s, some 6 million people have been killed, and the country has endured the genocidal violence and occupation of the Ugandan and Rwandan militaries, two proxy armies working at the disposal of Western imperialism, particularly American, Canadian, and British imperialism. Meanwhile, whole regions of the Democratic Republic of the Congo have been depopulated by genocidal paramilitary forces under the watchful eyes of the United Nations, which have also been occupying the Congo. And all the while, Western mining companies have been ravaging this country. Tonight, on the phone with us, we have with us Asad Ismi. Ismi is an international affairs correspondent for the Canadian Centers for Policy Alternatives Monitor. He is the author of The Ravaging of Africa, a highly acclaimed radio documentary about the destructive impact of U.S. imperialism on the continent. The Ravaging of Africa is based on Assad's article of the same title, which won a Project Censored Award. For Assad's publications, people can check out www.assadismi.ws. Welcome to Radio Basics, Assad. Are you on the line with us?
Thank you. Yes, Steve. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much for being on the phone with us tonight. Radio Basics welcomes you. If people have been watching the news in recent weeks, it seems like the civil war in the Congo is raging once again. Can you please give us a little bit of background as to what's happening there?
Right. The Congo War, which continues, is a horrifying example, I think, of all three instruments used by the U.S. government in its attempt to dominate Africa. The first is military invasion. So they sent the Ugandans and the Rwandans into the Congo in 1998 to take over its mineral resources and for the West, for Western corporations, and to loot it themselves as well. And then the second instrument is Western corporate plunder. Following the invasion, the corporations went in into the Congo under the occupation of Rwanda and Uganda and started looting the places where those armies were. And that looting continues till today. We see that in the Eastern Congo as well, where the war continues under the armed forces of General Nkunda. General Nkunda is a puppet of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And, of course, behind Rwanda is the United States. Rwanda's leader, Paul Kagame, is an American proxy who invaded the Congo in 1998 and left his henchman Nkunda there in order to continue pillaging the resources of the Eastern Congo, mm-hmm. which is very rich in coltan, especially.
Yeah, which is Colombo tantalite, right?
Right, Colombo and tantalite, which is the essential mineral required for laptop computers and cell phones, especially. Mm-hmm. So it's a very valuable mineral. And the Congo has 75% of it.
Of the world's
coltan. So that's where most of the coltan comes from. And without that coltan, without that looting, there would be no market for cell phones. You know, as we can see, so many millions of people in the West have cell phones now. And it's mainly because of the looting in the Congo that has made the price so low, that has made the cell phone so cheap.
And also kept corporations very rich, right?
Yes. I mean, it's opened up a whole market that didn't even exist before. You know, so if you think back 20 years or 10 years even, there was nobody had a cell phone. Now suddenly everybody's got one.
I think we should just, you know, make clear, because some people may, the conclusion that some people may draw from that is that therefore without genocide we can't have cell phones. But I see no reason why, you know, people using this technology can't be paying Africans and Congolese directly rather than these filthy rich mining companies which are carrying out the genocide, right?
And the phone companies.
And the phone companies.
That benefit a lot. As well, of course, you know, that can always be done. I mean, but the price of coltan would then go up, right? And then the cell phones would not be as ubiquitous as they are now, as they wouldn't be everywhere, because they would be much more expensive.
Sure, maybe they'd actually make them to last, eh?
Yeah.
Instead of breaking down within 6 months.
But this is the function of imperialism, is not to pay for resources, is to loot them.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that is what imperialism does. Because it requires the lowest price possible. And again, that is also a function of capitalism. Requiring the lowest price possible for a mineral means looting it. Looting it means killing millions of people, mm-hmm. in the case of the Congo. Because otherwise, the Congolese will demand a fair price for their minerals, of course.
Let's talk about imperialism for a moment. In particular, an inter-imperialist rivalry between the West and China right now.
Right.
Now, it's my understanding that around the time, just before the civil war re-broke out intensely around the Kivu, Lake Kivu area, the president of Democratic Republic of Congo, Joseph Kabila, had just signed a $9 billion trade deal with China. And it's my understanding that the rebel general, Laurent Nkunda, which is the puppet of Rwanda in the United States, as you've mentioned, at that point, they encircled, I believe, was it...
Goma.
Goma, yeah, the Goma around Lake Kivu, and they threatened the escalation of the conflict unless the trade deal was repealed?
Yes, you said that. He warned Kabila that unless he rejects the trade deal with China, which is actually much better for the Congo than anything they've ever got from the West.
Mm-hmm.
All they've got from the West is genocide and plunder. And the Chinese are offering $9 billion. So what would you rather have? 5 million of your people killed as they've been killed in this genocidal war started by the West in 1998? Or would you like $9 billion? What would you rather have?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no comparison. So there's China offering soft loans, credits, aid for building railways, roads, schools, hospitals, everything that the Congolese could ask for, this is a great trade deal for them, definitely for the Congolese. And there is the U.S. offering the Congo more genocide, more plunder, and more suffering. So no
mm-hmm.
comparison there. And this is what they're trying to stop, is this trade deal by killing more people in the eastern Congo.
Mm-hmm.
So why should Kabila listen to them?
Certainly. Now, can you give our listeners a little bit of background of the conflict? Go into more detail about how did Rwanda and Uganda end up in the Congo? What's the origins, the source of the civil war?
Right. That really starts with I think it starts with the imperialist rivalry in Africa between France and the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been going on for a while. France is quite prominent in Africa, especially in West Africa. It is prominent in the center as well. It was one of the main backers of Mobutu, who ruled Zaire, which was the old name for the Congo, for 36 years. And the U.S. was a backer of Mobutu as well. They put him in power. In 1961, when they killed the elected leader of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, whom you just talked about, mm-hmm. who's a hero for all of Africa. So he was killed by U.S. Agents, and then Mobutu was put in. And Mobutu was quite satisfactory to the U.S. for most of the 36 years until he started taking too much of the minerals and the riches of the Congo, which is the richest country in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So he started keeping too much of the wealth for himself and not giving enough to the Western corporations. So the U.S. got sick of him. And they overthrew him using the Ugandan and Rwandan armies in 1997. They invaded the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
And at the head of those armies was Laurent Kabila. And they were mm-hmm. using him to make it look like a Congolese invasion. But it wasn't. It was really a Rwandan Ugandan invasion.
That's right.
They overthrew Mobutu. He ran off to France. And then, however, Laurent Kabila turned around and asked the Rwandans and the Ugandans to leave his country because he said, well, thank you very much for your help, but it's my country and I'll rule it the way I want. And they refused. They left initially, but they were really angry about this, and they invaded the next year in 1998 under orders from Washington. And because they're U.S. proxies, and they won't do anything major without U.S. approval and encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. was angry about this because it wanted to take over the resources of the Congo, and Laurent was not going along with that. And so they, to teach him a lesson, they invaded through Rwanda and Uganda the next year in 1998. And that's when the big war started,
mm-hmm.
which went on till 2002, 2003. And in this war, 8 African armies were involved. On the side of Kabila, there were Angola, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. And they basically stopped the armies of Rwanda and Uganda from taking over the whole country. They helped Kabila set up his own army, the Congolese army. And then in 2002, the Rwandans and Ugandans had to sign a peace agreement, and then they withdrew most of their forces. But the Rwandans kept their puppet in the east, in the eastern Congo, General Ankunda, and his objective was to keep making trouble in the east in order to retain Rwandan control over the minerals over there. So
mm-hmm.
that's what he's doing to this day.
I think it's also interesting to note, you know, you mentioned that this civil war started when Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Congo.
Right.
We should also note that the so-called Rwandan genocide, and I say so-called because, you know, the way the narrative is constructed in the media is such that the so-called genocide period only refers to about 3 months of the civil war in Rwanda. And it's the 3 months when the forces who were opposed to American imperialism and British and Canadian as well were fighting back, and they were going on the attack against the forces that were that invaded the country, namely the Ugandan army, right, that invaded the country in 1991.
Right.
They depopulated hundreds of thousands of peasants from the countryside in Rwanda, and so the escalation of the conflict in 1994 was just one brief moment in the conflict. And then when President Paul Kagame comes to power by coup in 1994, that then becomes the beginning of U.S. Control over Rwanda, right? Which
right.
then results in both puppet governments in Uganda and Rwanda entering into the Congo. We don't have much time left, but one thing I want to briefly ask you about is the role of Canadian mining companies in the
right.
Congo. What has been their role?
Right. So the this is according to the United Nations panel of experts on the illegal exploitation of natural resources and other forms of wealth of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This they released a report in 2002, which identified 85 foreign multinational corporations that have been pillaging the resources of the Congo, and these include 8. Canadian mining companies. And hello?
Yeah, I'm still with you.
Right. They include 8 Canadian mining companies, and these are Banro Corporation, First Quantum Minerals, Kinross Gold, American Mineral Fields, International Panorama Resources, Benkei Mining, Melchior Resources, and Harambe Mining.
Are these subsidiaries of any larger companies that we might know?
Well, they're not subsidiaries. They are the actual companies.
Okay.
There is also the case of Barrick Gold. Barrick Gold is the largest gold mining company in the world,
yes.
And it's Canadian.
I was actually curious about that. That's why
yeah.
I asked.
Yeah. No, Banro and Barrick Gold have held mining properties in eastern Congo under Rwandan or Ugandan control. And according to Le Monde Diplomatique, both companies have been accused of funding military operations in exchange for lucrative contracts.
Mm-hmm.
According to intelligence specialist Wayne Madsen, who's worked for the U.S. National Security Agency, he testified to the U.S. Congress in 2001 that, quote, Barrick and tens of other mining companies are helping to stoke the flames of civil war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Madsen explained that Barrick signed a mining deal in 1999 with RCD Goma, a Rwanda-backed rebel group fighting the Congolese government.
Mm-hmm.
According to Madsen, one of the main goals of RCD was to, quote, restoration of mining concessions for Barrick Gold.
There you have it, right? Canadian imperialism.
Totally.
You know, working in the benefit of mining companies and at the expense of millions of people's lives.
Totally.
Asad Ismi, thank you very much for being with us. We're going to have to leave it at that, unfortunately.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
You're listening to radio journalist Asad Ismi. If you want to look up more of his publications, you can visit his website, which is www.asadismi.ws. We're going to go to a song, and we're going to be back with Ananya Mukherjee Reed, who's going to be talking about the bombings in Mumbai.
If there was no country for me, fighting for freedom long time, this world still ignoring me, then the whole world will be mine. If there was no country for me, fighting for freedom long time, this world still ignoring me. Born in a land where the oppressor maintains the upper hand, using treachery and lies to hide the cries. Why is the world keep their eyes shut? Those in power self-destruct, unable to instruct change. Who do I call out in vain? The pain and suffering, blood stains still hovering in my brain. What has the world learned from the wars it lost and the Holocaust? The millions of lives dedicated to freedom, one world, one cause. The answer should be too clear. We should begin by ending spending on nuclear arms. A world split on views between Christians, Hindus, Jews, and Islam is run purely by greed and commerce. Terror is emboldened by states today than any time in history. Again, the answer is too clear, it ain't no mystery. We need nuclear thinkers that can act as the pain lingers. The third world needs helping hands, but instead gets trigger fingers.
Then the whole world will be mine. If there was no country for me, fighting for freedom long time, this world still ignoring me, then the whole world will be mine. If there was no country for me, fighting for freedom long time, this world still ignoring me.
Tell me why there's no protection. My people still suffering while they always in depression. I'll tell you why, cause we've all been through struggle. When your family's taken away and you feel your heart crumble, fighting for a land with no choice, we had to smuggle ourselves and take our loved ones to a place with no trouble. Seeing so much pain, our hearts became so humble. We spread our voices for the ones in constant fear, hoping one day that this world will disappear. Minds are traumatized and we feel that death is near. Please tell me, God, why are all these enemies here? All these lives taken away, all these homes I see destructed, mothers taken away, all these infants in corruption. So we've grown with war noises, for our people have no choices but to fight back these explosions left with scared crying voices. For my Tamils, love your country, always fight back these forces.
Then the whole world will be mine. If there was no country for me, fighting for freedom long time, this world still ignoring me, then the whole world will be mine. If there was no country for me, fighting for freedom long time, this world still ignoring me.
Let's be honest, our blood type patriotic, panic in their eyes, thinking we're schizophrenic. Seize them, don't let them fight for freedom. Beat them, do what you can to mistreat them. Steal them, cause their rights they can't keep them. This is why we fight till we defeat them. Pull out the lead, leave the army in bloodshed. Now I regret with these thoughts in my head. Were they there to help or take our wealth? The pain we felt, so we killed ourselves. The dead reincarnated who've been through.
Hello, you're listening to Radio Basics on CHRY 105.5 FM. And that was No Country For Us by Lil Empire, one of the leading Tamil hip-hop groups here in Toronto, coming out of Malvern Scarborough. As many of you have heard, the story dominating news coverage over the past few days has been the attacks in Mumbai, India, that began this past Wednesday and have since claimed the lives of over 170 people. The attacks included a network of raids, bombings, and hostage takings that affected over 9 locations throughout southern Mumbai, including its famous crowded railway station, and as has received particular attention from the corporate press, two luxury hotels serving foreign tourists. The horrific, tragic attacks have elicited international front-page coverage and immediate response from Western and Indian leaders. However, these forces were also just as quick to blame Muslim terrorists and suggest Pakistani involvement before any investigation could take place. And mainstream discussion about the tragedy has carefully and deliberately removed and twisted important points about the national and regional situation in which the bombings occurred. Here on the line to discuss the Mumbai rampage and its ramifications for the people of India and the region is Ananya Mukherjee Reed. She's the assistant professor of political science at York University and the author of a number of books, including Perspectives on the Indian Corporate Economy and Human Development and Social Power. She joins us on the line from here in Toronto. Hey, Ananya, and thanks for coming on today.
Hi, glad to be here.
Definitely. So first of all, just briefly from your information, what is the situation in Mumbai and India as a whole right now, 5 days after the initial attack?
Well, as you can imagine, it's left everybody traumatized. The death toll is actually hovering around 200, and one of the news channels is reporting actually more than 200, and a number of injured is well past 350, and one doesn't exactly know how many the counts would be coming in. And then life is slowly limping back to normal, but there is a lot of anger directed primarily to politicians in the first instance, because it is believed that there was actually quite a bit of intelligence. There was quite a bit of almost direct security warning, which came until about 24 hours before the actual attack. And nothing seems to have been done about it at all. And these, actually, in Maharashtra, the state where Mumbai is located, these kind of attacks have been happening. Not this kind, I should not say that. But blasts have been occurring in some frequency. And so people had expected that steps had been taken, but they hadn't. So the Home Minister actually had resigned, and who was our Finance Minister until yesterday is now the Home Minister. And the Prime Minister, Dr. Manmohan Singh, has taken additional charge of the Finance Ministry. In addition, the Chief Minister of the Maharashtra State and his additional Deputy Chief Minister both have been asked to resign, and they are going to be, there's going to be new heads in there very soon. And there's also talk of some other heads rolling. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the first knee-jerk response, because remember, India is also gearing up for elections. Some mm-hmm. elections are actually yes. already on, and so the government is in major damage control mode. But I think it's also really, really scared about what the implications can be. Mm-hmm. And the reactions are also a little bit like in the U.S. After 9/11, that there has to mm-hmm. be a national security agency, federal agency for terror. And the most obvious fallout, which we can at this stage only speculate on, but the danger lies in the escalation of the relationships between India and Pakistan, which were on a slightly better trend over the mm-hmm. last a little over the recent past, and that
yes,
has taken
they
a
were.
Real hit.
Yeah, exactly. No, I do think one of the really troubling questions raised about these terrorist attacks
right.
Is the fact that these Indian federal elections are just months away with
right.
a potential win for what is essentially an openly fascist Hindu party, the BJP, that is now urging the Indian state to use the American model of 9/11 to respond to the attacks. And this is in a country where, you know, the impoverished Muslim minority of 200 million is already facing harassment and brutality at the hands of these police and anti-terror laws and officials. So what are the internal ramifications?
Right. Internal ramifications are kind of along the lines of what you were saying, that there is a real danger of this being exploited by the BJP, and they have already been coming out with paid advertisements in the major newspapers saying how inept this government is and it cannot, and the whole sort of anti-Pakistan, anti-Muslim line is come back it's really whatever little direction along secular lines that was re-emerging in the recent past has really gotten sidetracked, and there is a real danger of political capitalization by the BJP. Now, maybe out of optimism or maybe out of naivety, I still want to hope that this kind of absolutely naked politicization of this trauma, which people are going through right now by the BJP, will be seen for what it is. And even if people think, and there seems to be indications that there are some pointers towards Pakistan and a full-fledged international investigation is on, even if that is true, one would hope that it will proceed through channels of providing legitimate evidence and then having that being vetted and there being sort of a political judicial process in place rather than an escalation of war, rather than, you know, going in the direction of war. So I want to hope that in the end, good sense will prevail, but as I said, this could be my optimism or my naivety, I don't know. But there is danger at this point of the kind of fallout that is already happening, and one doesn't really know what to trust, because on the one hand, I think the Indian government is feeling compelled to put up a posture which is very stern towards Pakistan. Now, whether that necessarily means that we are going down the path of military escalation, right, that I do not know as of now. And again, I want to believe that if the question comes of downright war, then people would understand that that is not in the best interest of anybody in the long run. The other thing I wanted to say, because you were talking about the discontent and the deprivation of Indian Muslims, right? That is absolutely true. And the more we look at the data that comes out, the more, I don't even know what is the right word for it, that there could be really this kind of lack of change of a community that almost from the time of partition until now, there has been a marginalization of the largest sections of the Muslim. But I do want to separate that from the question of whether all that discontent finds expression in violence. I do not think so. I think the ordinary Muslim citizen of India is as traumatized and is as willing to work through institutions, even though he or she may be marginalized, rather than to take recourse to violence. And so I think that, you know, while we must acknowledge the marginalization and the deprivation, we must not draw the conclusion that therefore there exist the conditions for people taking recourse to violence. There is, of course, in every society.
Anyanya, unfortunately, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We have to go to a quick commercial break, but we'll be right back with you.
Sure.
Thank you. Welcome back to Radio Basics. On the line, we have Ananya Mukherjee Reed, assistant professor of political science here at York University, to discuss the recent Mumbai bombings. Now, Ananya, before the commercial break, we were just discussing the bombings, framing it, you know, that we have to caution ourselves not to support any kind of acts of terror now by the Indian state being framed as in response to these bombings. Now, you know, there's been a number of really disturbing points about this whole investigation, including, in fact, this blaming, immediate blaming of Islamic terrorists. Right now, I think the organization that's being blamed is Lashkar-e-Taiba. Even though Pakistani officials say that they have no evidence provided to them about any Pakistani group involvement. And in fact, this recent, the one gunman that was captured alive, who claims to be a Pakistani, there's actually no, initial searches have found no record of him, of anyone by his name ever living in Pakistan. And also, interestingly enough, he could speak perfect English. So in addition to this, there's been another... there's been the very interesting point of the fact that security agencies and intelligence agencies were repeatedly warned of such an attack, including that it would be conducted on the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel.
Right.
And not only was nothing done to address these alerts, but security for the area was actually removed 3 weeks ago.
Right.
What are your thoughts on this?
Right. See, a couple of things. I mean, on what you said that, you know, people have not, I mean, there is no evidence. I don't think what has been revealed until now is evidence. They're pointers, although this particular gunman who has been captured apparently has confessed to being a member or having been trained. His main training has been done by groups such as Lashkar-e-Taiba. Now, the problem with that, and it has already been raised in the Pakistani media, that, you know, if they are trained in as tough a way as they are, that they get captured and within a few hours they actually reveal all about which group they belong to, hasn't at least convinced them, because everybody on the Pakistan side has been insisting on evidence, and on the Indian side they've been saying this is evidence. So I think there is really that gap which has often existed in these investigations between what is a pointer and what could be developed into an evidence. That should be followed through in this case, because it is such a major case. And the second question you raised was about how security... This is the puzzle. This is the real puzzle, that there were specific threats that it is going to be by sea route, and that the Taj and the Oberoi, both of which were attacked, there were specific threats on those two. And the anti-terrorism squad chief who died had actually asked these hotels personally to beef up security. Now, the owner of the Taj said that, yes, you're right, that they had just begun to lax the security mechanism they had put. But he said that even if it had succeeded, the attackers had actually come from the back, and he was surprised as to how well they knew the lay of the Taj. And that's one question that has been really raised, that how is it possible? Even the Indian commandos have raised this question, that they found it really difficult to navigate the landscape of the hotel, because it's an old architectural building, not the straight foyer type organization. But the attackers actually could engage them because they knew exactly where to go, and they had set up a room, a control room, they had stacked ammunition. So this one is very, very difficult to crack, but how could all this go on in this way? And they had come to Mumbai several times before to find out what was where. So how could that happen? And I think the answer is, as I said, a very, very deep failure. But, you know, behind this, I think it's not only just a failure of intelligence or security, it's certainly that, but I think a deeper failure of governance in a way which had become too focused on the stock market and on how to prop up, they had managed the financial crisis very well, how to prop up liquidity, how to maintain profitability, and all of those things.
And some people have even raised, have also raised the possibility of an interest in letting the bombings take place.
Well, yes, and whose interest that would be. Mm-hmm. I mean, because, I mean, there are now questions being raised as to, you know, why the fire brigade was so late in coming, mm-hmm. why the commandos were so late in arriving. And the commandos did a wonderful job when they came. It's just not clear why it took 9 hours for them to come when the actual air travel time is about 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, this we have this also, this police chief who was assassinated,
right.
Mr. Hemata Karkare,
right.
who was actually in the process, had a hit out on him by a number of Hindu nationalist organizations and was in the process of investigating a previous bombing and had actually already arrested a number of Hindu right-wing activists, including
about
a
10.
Police constable.
Yeah, well, not only a police constable, actually a lieutenant colonel of the army.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them are in custody right now. And not only the ATF chief, but the three top anti-terrorist squad officials who were, on the one hand, involved in this case, the one that you mentioned, you know, which were also initially blamed to external forces. So on the one hand, they were investigating this. And on the other hand, there's a local I won't even call him a politician, Raj Thackeray, who fans up this local, the conflict between people who are local Maharashtrians and people who've come from the outside, and a very, very extremist kind of wing of Hindutva groups. So all of this put together, it becomes really difficult, you know, if you ask the ultimate question that is asked in detective novels, that, you know, who gains, right?
Yes.
Then it's not so clear that it's in the interest of the Pakistani government to do something like this. And actually, the Indian government has said that our allegation is not against the Pakistani government. They actually, this time, they haven't even called ISI's name. They've specifically named this group,
mm-hmm.
which they are saying that Pakistani establishment must be able to control.
Mm-hmm. And, so, and then raises important questions as to whose interests were fulfilled, including elites in India and the rest of the world. Unfortunately, we're running out of time here. We have to end at 9. But just briefly, very briefly, conclusion, you know, these are definitely not the largest acts of terrorism or, you know, in India or South Asia
mm-hmm.
in recent years. In Pakistan, you know, we've have well over 170 that have been killed by U.S. airstrikes alone.
Mm-hmm.
In India, we have also a number of state terror and Hindu extremist terrorist acts, including the massacre of over 2,000 Muslim civilians in Gujarat in 2002.
Right.
More than tenfold, you know, those murdered last week, but of course received less than 1/10 of the news coverage and provoked no demands for any kind of anti-state terror laws.
Yeah.
So briefly in conclusion, why
is that so?
Mm-hmm, and why is there such an outrage and outpouring of demands around this recent massacre?
First of all, just look at how it was planned. Whoever planned it and whoever's interest, the idea was to get maximum attention, maximum global attention, and that's why Mumbai, that's why the two luxury hotels, that's why the Gateway of India, and also it's very different from the bomb blasts that have been occurring. It is basically a frontal attack by gunmen, right? Who are kind of professionally trained. Everybody says that they are really professionally trained and fully armed and with extremely well supplied and everything. So it was meant for maximum impact. And I think the earlier blast had indicated that the security infrastructure was in terrible shambles. And so something like this could be done, and it was actually planned over at least 3 or 4 months. So the impact was planned, and the takeover of the very little known Jewish house there of the Israeli citizens and so on. All of this was done in a very planned way for maximum impact. That's what we had. And the outrage is kind of also the horror of it. But I would have to say that, you know, in all fairness, within India, the media and the civil society has actually tried to raise, draw attention to all of that, has all of the things that you mentioned.
Mm.
It's only the international media that has not paid attention to those things. And right now, the international media has paid it. And that was the deliberate plan, that we are going to get the world pay attention and ultimately bring a message also. I think this has implications for Obama's strategies as well.
Definitely, Ananya. I'm really sorry to cut you off.
No problem.
Very important discussion. Thank you so much for coming on today. And we'll definitely follow very carefully what the fallout, both internally in India and regionally, the impact, and how this is used by American imperialism and the Indian state, these horrific bombings. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And we'll be following the events.
Thank you. Bye.
That's it, unfortunately, for Radio Basics this Monday. The first time in our new slot here at CHRY 105.5. Thank you so much for listening. A reminder, a shout out for the event next week, Wednesday. That's going to be 5 p.m. at the Anit Africa Dub Theater. Make sure to check the Basics website, Basics, communitynewsletter.blogspot.com, about information about that and all the other stories of community organizing that's happening right here in Toronto. Thank you so much for listening. This is Kabir.
This is Steve, Radio Basics. We're out.
Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Uh-uh, we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.